Following in the footsteps of both his grandfathers, Patrick Hennessy brought his Oxford University degree into the British Army. He went to Sandhurst, which he was quick to tell me is not the British West Point.
Now, there is this difference. Sandhurst is a year-long, very specific military officer training course. You don't get a college degree out of it. About 80% of my peers on the course had already done a degree, like myself. About 20% hadn't done a degree and weren't planning on it. They were either school leavers or they were people who'd come up through the ranks as enlisted men. And I think my decision was informed by a number of factors. I was at university from 2000 to 2003, and I was hugely privileged. I was at Oxford. It's this wonderful kind of centre of learning, this beautiful ancient town. You feel constantly surrounded by how lucky you are to be studying there. And of course, 2000 to 2003, in one respect, was boom time. You know, all my friends were walking into high-paid jobs. Everything was kind of healthy with the economy. But it was also the 3 years in which the September the 11th attacks happened here in New York, and we went to war first in Afghanistan and then in Iraq. And suddenly, joining the army was a decision which meant not that you might, on a chance, get sent to somewhere dangerous, but that you probably would definitely get sent to somewhere dangerous. And it actually had a bit more of a meaning to it.
And once you were out of Sandhurst and in the military, I can see the value of the Sandhurst education to your prospects. Were there any advantages to the university background? Did you find that your Oxford days were a help or a hindrance with the men you were about to serve with?
I think on a practical level, you know, obviously being able to knock out an essay on the kind of metaphysical poetry of John Donne is not necessarily going to help you in downtown Basra. But I'm a kind of great believer in university education as being impractical. It shouldn't be practical. It should be kind of esoteric, and it should broaden the mind. And I think it gives you perspective. And there's something very terrifying about when you commission for the first time from Sandhurst. And I was 23 years old, and I suddenly found myself in command of a platoon of 30 soldiers who were all more experienced than me, and I had a platoon sergeant who was 10 years older than me, who knew everything inside out. And the only thing that sort of gives you any advantage as a graduate is having a slightly different life perspective, and maybe that's what allows you to sort of think outside the box a bit and come up with the unconventional solution when you're presented with the problem. And after all, that's why you earn slightly more money.
Did you find others there who had similar backgrounds? Is that, in fact, where the Junior Officers Reading Club came from?
That's exactly where the Junior Officers Reading Club came from. It was very bizarre. I was in a mess where, I think probably unusually for an infantry mess, there were four or five of us among 30 young officers who'd all been at the same university. A number of us had all read literature, which was what I majored in. And so we had this sort of very strange vibe of, on the one level, here we were all infantry soldiers, and we were out in places like Bosnia and Iraq, and we were wanting to test ourselves in combat. But we also had this kind of background of reading and books that we still valued, and we wanted to sort of somehow keep alive.
So as members of the Junior Officers Reading Club, did you actually read books? Did you discuss books?
Well, we did. I mean, it wasn't a sort of formal book club as you might kind of have out in the suburbs. But what happened was when we deployed out to Iraq for the first time, we realized we'd be spending 6 months away from home and with a very strict kind of weight limit. So there wasn't a lot you could take with you to sort of keep you comfortable. And about five books per person was the maximum. So what we wanted to do was try and deconflict our five books to make sure we weren't taking two of the same book, which would be a waste of space, and to make sure that we'd all want to read each other's books. So we had a sort of little get-together beforehand, made sure everybody was taking something that everybody else would like. And then once we got to Iraq, we found that although we were very busy and there was sort of different kinds of pressure, sometimes the kind of the excitement and adrenaline of going out on patrol, other times the sort of difficulty that comes with being in a quite boring and hot base routine, the way we could escape from that was maybe once or twice a week when our schedules allowed, just trying to grab half an hour or an hour, all sat together behind our tent and just relaxing. And that could be reading, or it could be chatting about whatever it was that people had just read, or it could just be teasing the one guy that didn't like reading and preferred surfing magazines.
I'm curious as to what some of the books were that you took when you were sitting around behind the tents, having been out, weapons ready, during the day, and come back and you're looking for a moment of escape or relaxation. What books did you have there to make sure that you had the kind of discussion you wanted to?
Yeah, well, this is it. It was a fascinatingly eclectic mix. I mean, on the one hand, we had what you'd kind of think are all the kind of classics of war writing, Hearst's Dispatches, Chicken Hawk, a lot of writing from the Vietnam era, which was a kind of a conflict, which obviously is very high in the consciousness of my generation. Older stuff as well, Robert Graves' First World War memoir, Goodbye to All That. I had Heller, Catch 22, which I still think is one of the kind of great war books. So there was that. There was this kind of strangeness of being at war and also reading about war. But then there was also the pure escapism, the stuff that we sort of maybe treasured from back home. I had a lot of Evelyn Waugh's kind of satirical novels from the 1920s out there. I had Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, sort of child's book, but again, a wonderful escape. And another friend had some Bret Easton Ellis, which we thought was just hilarious to be sat out under the canvas in southern Iraq reading about the kind of excesses of Easton Ellis's kind of East Coast life. It was all very strange, this balance between what was relevant and what was completely different, an escapism.
There are a lot of examples in your book, The Junior Officers Reading Club, of times when you and your men are physically uncomfortable. You don't, in the book, talk much about being afraid. In fact, it seems when the bullets are flying and the bombs are dropping, sometimes you seem almost gleeful. Is that simply because that's what you went there to do?
I think it's a deeply personal thing, and I suspect through nothing other than a complete accident of fate, I was very fortunate in some way I was wired. Maybe it was kind of sense of responsibility. Maybe it was a fear of not wanting to let down the guys who you were supposed to be in charge of. I never acutely felt like something terrible was around the corner. And in fact, I had a good friend who was shot in the leg, and he's absolutely fine now. But I remember speaking to him afterwards in hospital, and he said, I just woke up that morning and I knew. And the whole day I was kind of terrified and I was waiting for something to happen. And I think guys like that are far more courageous than those who just found that we could kind of run around and not really think about it, because they're going through the motions, actually fighting against something within themselves. I think kind of fear and courage and all those things, you learn a lot about them when you're in a conflict. And they're very malleable concepts. I've seen the bravest guy for the last 3 months suddenly have one incident that tips him over the edge, and then he hasn't got anything left in the tank. And you've seen the guy who you thought was going to be absolutely rubbish all through training, who you are really worried about, who is a lion on the battlefield. So the kind of how that works, how you motivate yourself, is very strange. But I think most soldiers, the lack of physical comfort is a more constant and therefore somehow more acute thing. And I think because fear is more personal, maybe we internalized it and didn't discuss it so much.
I suspect that for people who haven't been there, it's hard to understand how the constancy of physical discomfort can mean more to you than the fear of getting shot at. Didn't you worry about getting killed, getting wounded?
I think there's a sort of part stoical thing. Most of the intense fighting I did was with the Afghan National Army, and the Afghans we were working alongside had this sort of slightly haphazard inshallah mentality, kind of God willing, you know, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen. If it's not going to happen, it's not going to happen. There's no point in worrying about it. And I think you're absolutely right that to people who've never been in that situation, it seems absurd. You know, the old joke in black and white war movies is the general visits the front and he always asks, you know, is the mail getting through on time? And that's genuinely it. You know, the biggest concern of a soldier is not tomorrow I might get blown up by an IED. It's, you know, I haven't had a letter from my wife from home for a week. And I think that's because you know somewhere deep down that that threat is constantly around the corner. And you can't sustain a six-month tour dwelling on that threat. You've got to get on with the job in hand. So you focus on the easier things to cope with. And then there is also, as you say in the book, this sort of slight sense of glee. And I know a lot of people have read the book and felt sort of uncomfortable with that or surprised by that. How can you be deriving a sense of enjoyment from something as terrible as being in a fight? And I think there's the combination of the adrenaline that kicks in, the kind of survival high that you get after a fight when you've got through it all and you have all survived and everyone's come out without a scratch. And I think those are very powerful drivers as well.
You dedicated your book to your two grandfathers, which would be normal in many cases, but it is particularly apt in yours. And I wondered if you would tell me a little bit about these two men.
It was absolutely the natural thing for me to do. And I finished writing this book and I thought, well, actually, this has got to be dedicated to my grandfathers, because they were the two sort of models for me as I was going through this army career, having come out of a sort of university career. My father's father was a archetypal military man, a Second World War veteran. He was one of the lead attack tanks on the morning of D-Day on the British beaches and had spent his whole career in the military. And my mother's father was a conscientious objector, an academic. He drove ambulances during the war because he didn't believe in fighting. And so they were very, very different men. And as it turned out, absolutely the best of friends when they met and their children got married and had grandchildren. And so I always felt very conscious that although I had sort of decided to become a soldier and was following more obviously in my military grandfather's footsteps, I was doing so with this kind of liberal academic background and hopefully being sort of thoughtful about it as my other grandfather would have wished.
It's a curious thing, isn't it? It's worth exploring what it was that these two men found in each other that you wouldn't expect to be there. One a conscientious objector, the other a military man, but both, I guess you'd have to say, showing a real courage in pursuit of their ideals.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the sort of courage that it must have taken in the 40s to say, I have real trouble with this, with what's happening kind of morally and ethically, so I'm not going to be swept up in the tide. I can't even imagine that. And likewise, the courage that my military grandfather must have had to sort of the intensity of fighting in Northwest Europe. I mean, we've all seen things like Saving Private Ryan and Band of Brothers, but here was this man of his generation who just very quietly sort of sat in his corner in his chair smoking his pipe and didn't really talk about that. But you knew he'd been through that. I was also kind of very struck by the fact that they'd both written books. Obviously my grandfather, who was an academic, that was part and parcel of his career, but that my military grandfather had decided later in life, having not really spoken to any members of his family about what he went through, to put his experiences down on the page. So again, that was something that informed me when I was going through writing the book, which I found personally a very kind of therapeutic process, that it was something that they'd both been through as well.
Patrick Hennessy resigned from the British Army as its youngest frontline captain. His book is The Junior Officers Reading Club.